Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Our guest today is Jesus Fernandez Villaverde. Jesus is a professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania, a research associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research, and a research affiliate with the Center for Economic Policy Research. Jesus specializes in economic history and macroeconomic modeling. He has published in top journals and is currently working on several books in economic history. Today, he joins us to talk about European economic history and the state of affairs with macroeconomic modeling. Jesus, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you on. Tell us, how did you get into economics?
Okay. Well, so as I guess my name betrays, I'm originally from Spain. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid in the mid-1980s, the Spanish economy was experiencing a deep transition. We had moved from a dictatorship to democracy. We were joining what was known at the time as the European Communities, which later became the European Union, and we were recovering from a huge economic crisis. And, you know, just from watching the news, reading the newspapers, they cover economic policy all the time, and I just got hooked on it. So maybe a little bit early, when I was only 14 years old, I decided I wanted to be an economist. bit earlier than other people. However, my goal at the time was not to be a professor. I wanted to be a top civil servant. I know that for many Americans, you know, this may sound strange that when you're 15, you want to become a top civil servant in the Bank of Spain or the Ministry of Finance. But in many European countries, top civil service jobs are really regarded as highly prestigious occupations. They are very well paid, and they are the door to a lot of other opportunities, like becoming politicians, top managers in the business world, etc. So I went to a university that had this joint degree in economics and law. It was a six-year degree in opposition to a regular four-year degree, but it was a perfect preparation for the civil service exam. Unfortunately, by the end of my second year, I realized I didn't want to be a top civil servant anymore. What I really wanted to be was a professor. Okay. And, you know, I saw that the best economic research was doing in the US, people like Bob Lucas, Tom Sarien, Neil Wallace. So I say that's what mm-hmm. I want to do. So I started working pretty hard and trying to prepare myself to go to graduate school. I was lucky. I got accepted into Minnesota. And, you know, I got there and didn't go so badly after that. So that's a little bit the story.
Now, you are both strong in economic history and mm-hmm. in macroeconomic modeling. So you do very technical DSGE type analysis, but you also do pretty extensive economic history. I mean, you have several books you're working on, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So tell us about these books you're working on. What do they cover?
Okay, so I'm working on three of them at the same time, which is probably a very bad idea. and I should work only on one of them and finish. But anyway, let me tell you. So the first one is actually macro. It's pure macro. It's a textbook in dynamic macroeconomics with my colleague, Dirk Kruger, who is also a professor at Penn. And the idea was to write a book that was covering the gap between your average intermediate macro textbook. Think about, I don't know, Olivier Blanchard or Greg Mankiw of any of the other standard mm-hmm. Macro textbooks, and, you know, Lundqvist Sargent recursive macroeconomic theory. The goal is to explain advanced macro, but without a lot of math. And that makes it, I think, a very nice project, because you cannot really hide yourself behind math. You really need to explain the mechanism. We have been working on this for many, many years now. I will say we are around 75% done, and we would really like to send it to the publisher by next summer. So okay. that's kind of pure macro. In economic history, which you know, maybe people will find a little bit more attractive, I have been teaching global economic history now, I think, for maybe 8-9 years. Mm-hmm. So I started writing up my notes. I was not very happy with any of the textbooks that existed on the topic. Most of the textbooks are very Western European oriented. Basically, they talk about the Industrial Revolution in England and coal and steel, and they only touch very lightly on maybe China or India or Africa. And also, they have not incorporated a lot of what we have learned in economic history over the last 20 years, which is really. So I figured out, well, I may start writing this up, and little by little, I have been accumulating material. I have now perhaps around 500 pages. But there is still a lot to go because the project is very ambitious. So my objective at this moment is to accumulate enough sabbatical credits and take 1 year on leave and finish it, maybe in 1 year or two. I have been circulating already a few of the chapters, and you know, they have been well received. People seem to like them, but I really need to work hard. And finally, the third project, which is a little bit what I'm focusing right now in the very short run, is a joint project with Tano Santos, who is a professor at Columbia University. And we are trying to think about the history of monetary unions and the political economy of those monetary unions. This was motivated by my research on the Eurozone area and the political credit cycles on the Euro area. And basically, we want to understand why countries enter into monetary unions, how the political economy of these countries evolve after they have entered into the monetary union, and how monetary unions eventually break down. Because so far, we have had a few cases of monetary unions that have survived, think about the US, but also many other cases of monetary unions that have broken down. The Eurozone, the jury is still out, so we need to see what happens in a decade or so. And right now, what we are doing is we are trying to outline the argument, making it a little bit sharper than in some of the papers we have written about it. And we are doing a lot of background reading. I have spent the last couple of weeks actually reading a lot about European Union law and the European Union process of integration, the banking union, etc.
Yes. In fact, we're going to talk about one of your papers here shortly. Yes. As it regards the Eurozone. What's interesting, though, is that you're doing this quite in depth. So you mentioned you got 500 pages into your global economic history.
Yeah.
But if someone was to go look at your research, they would also find some very, you know, sophisticated models. I mean, yeah. It's almost as if you're defying the law of comparative advantage, right? I mean, this isn't typical. So how were you able to get specialized in both areas so ably?
I don't know. I guess that the counterfactual will be if I were specializing in only one of them, I could be doing a much better job.
Okay. Good point.
So who knows?
All right. Fair enough.
In fact,
I'll mention to our listeners that Jesus has a new chapter out in the new handbook of macroeconomics on DSGE modeling. So something to look forward to. All right. Let's move into European economic history. And I want to kind of focus on monetary institutions, monetary history, and kind of Germany in the focus, the focal point, because of some interesting conversations we've had, you and I had offline. And to motivate this, let's go back to the early 1920s when Germany has just lost World War I. They're coming out of it, and they have their hyperinflation experience. And let's start there. Tell us, what led to this hyperinflation and what was the resolution to it?
Okay, so let me give you a little bit of background on how World War I ends in Germany. Basically, what happens is by the summer of 1918, the British have put on the ground an extremely successful army. The British have been able to finally put together what is sometimes known as joint arms operation. They are the first to truly integrate modern artillery, tanks, airplane support, etc. And especially with the help of the extra soldiers from the United States and all the economic and financial support of the United States, it is very clear that the Allies are going to win the war. And by September of 1918, German elites decide it is better to surrender, to accept Wilson's proposal for a negotiated peace, or what they believe was going to be a negotiated peace, than to be defeated on the ground. At the same moment, there is a lot of unhappiness and mutinies within the German Navy, and that precipitates the fall of the monarchy in Germany and a very quick fall to World War I. Why is this important? Because a lot of people in Germany finish the war without having interiorized they have lost the war. They thought they have, you know, reached some type of truce slash peace agreement where, yes, they were not doing so well, but they have not really been defeated. That's not true. They have really been defeated militarily, but a lot of the people in Germany have not understood this point. This means that when the Versailles Treaty is passed, it's a tremendous shock to a lot of Germans. They think the treaty is unfair. They thought they have arranged some type of negotiated peace, and instead of a negotiated peace, what they are being offered is what historians call a diktat, a set of surrender terms. And in particular, a lot of Germans do not want to cooperate with the clauses of the treaty. This leads, after a number of conflicts, to the French and the Belgians occupying West Germany, the Rhine area. And the German government responds by asking the citizens in that area not to work, and they will pay their wages. So in that way, the French and the Belgians will not be able to, the Belgians will not be able to get anything out of this area, and the German government will pay for the expenses of people living there. Of course, this leads to an hyperinflation because there is just not enough money. And the hyperinflation completely wipes out the savings of a lot of the middle class and upper middle class in Germany. And that leaves a deep sense of resentment with the Weimar Republic. So think about, try to put yourself in the skin of an upper middle class German lawyer in 1923. You are very patriotic. You are very nationalistic because Germany was an extremely nationalistic country at the time. And basically what you see is this Weimar Republic, who you believe has accepted a totally unfair peace treaty, and that has generated this hyperinflation, that has made lost all your savings for the last 3-4 decades. You are bitter, you are unhappy, you are completely willing to listen to someone who will come from the outside and tell you that he has a different way to do things. And this means that after 1923, there is going to be quite a lot of small parties on the right gathering the votes of all these unhappy voters. Some of them are going to be more radical. Some of them are going to be a little bit more moderate. The more radical ones, one of them will be, of course, the National Socialist, the Nazi Party. But there were many others that actually got relatively better electoral performance than the Nazis for a while. And there was a more mainstream party called the German National People's Party, the DNVP, mm-hmm. who was the party of the big Junkers, the big land owners, the monarchies, the officers in the army, etc. And without being the type of thugs like the Nazis that will go out on the street and beat up people, they were quite hyper-nationalist and authoritarian. And the Weimar Republic, surprisingly enough, stabilizes a little bit after 1924. There are a few years of prosperity. There is a bloc constituted by the Catholic Party, by the Liberals, and by the Social Democrats, who are more or less able to put together stable coalition governments for a few years. But this stability is completely a mirage. In 1929, the Great Depression comes, and Germany enters into a very, very big economic crisis, and this will give enormous power to these parties on the right wing.
Well, let me go back and talk about the inflation, the hyperinflation a bit. Mm-hmm. So it was very severe. Today, if you read German commentary, it's often alluded to or referenced as a warning against any kind of profligacy at the central bank.
Yeah.
It's in the German mindset, the German psyche, and it's hard not to see it. And so one of the interesting questions I've had and I've wrestled with, and this is what led us to our conversation, is Why do Germans tend to remember this hyperinflation more than they do the Great Depression and the deflation around that? And because part of the reason that motivated that question, and this is where you can add some clarification, is kind of a standard narrative has been told, maybe incorrectly, is that the reason the Nazis come to power is because of the Great Depression. Things get so horrible, so painful. They look to a savior. The Nazis rise up. And there's some empirical evidence, but you told me that's a much more complicated story than that. So I guess two questions. One, why do the Germans remember the hyperinflation more than they do the Great Depression? And two, what is the link between the Great Depression and the rise of the Nazis?
Okay. So with respect to the first question, my answer is going to be more tentative than the second one. On the first one, it's going to be a little bit more of an hypothesis. The second one, I believe I have a tighter answer. I think that the inflations affect everyone. Everyone that has a little bit of savings lost everything they have, and it's very clear that this is unfair, at least in the minds of people. And great recessions, on the other hand, are very unequal on the way people are affected by them. If you keep your job in Germany in 1930, 1931, and the key, of course, here is if you keep your job, okay? I want to be very open about that. Life is not so bad. Yeah, maybe your wages have gone down 10%, 5%, but guess what? Prices are minus 20, minus 25%. So suddenly your real income is higher. So the people that kept their jobs do not necessarily remember very hard economic crisis in bad ways. I have experienced that myself in the case of Spain. If you talk with some of my friends or my relatives that kept their jobs between 2009, 2013, they don't have particularly bad memories of those years. You know, they will tell you things which, you know, sounds a little bit frivolous, but true nevertheless. So they will say, oh, in 2012, it was so easy to call to a good restaurant and find a table.
Huh,
now again, it's difficult again to find a table. Or let me tell you just one anecdote. You know, my parents, thankfully enough, were not affected by the crisis. And you ask my mom about the crisis, and what she will tell you will be something like, oh, you know, in 2012, I wanted to renovate the bathroom. So I called the contractor, and the contractor say, I will be there in 15 minutes. And he was there in 15 minutes.
Hmm.
2005, you call a contractor and he will tell you, well, I will show up in 6 months if you are lucky. So inflations are in that sense, hyperinflations, not normal, but hyperinflations tend to be much wider in their impact, and they tend to affect also more of the middle and upper middle classes, tend to create the narratives, the what the French historians call the lieux de mémoire, the places of memory that future generations remember. You are a writer and you are going to write about the hyperinflation. You are a historian. You are going to write about the hyperinflation. You are a poor and skilled worker. Your plight during the Great Depression is very sad and very hard, but you are not going to, in that sense, affect the national memory in the same way. And the second point I would like to add about that is that I think many people in Germany see the link between the hyperinflation and the problems of 1929-1933 as a continuum.
Okay.
They will tell you, no. 1929 will have never happened without the hyperinflation of 1923. And I think that they have a little bit of a point. Maybe not the full truth, but a little bit of a point they do have.
You know, it's interesting. So your argument is that, you know, hyperinflation affects everyone. It doesn't discriminate. It takes away everyone's earnings as well as upper income folks. And so they write the history. They are upset. Whereas the Great Depression, there's winners, there's some losers. And that's a convincing story. What's interesting, if you go to the U.S. perspective, right, it seems like almost every macroeconomist in the U.S., if you ask them what's the defining moment, right, it's going to be the Great Depression. Now, I guess I can't say whether it's as important in the average American's mind as maybe inflation is in the German's mind, but it seems at least macroeconomists here, there's a bias towards avoiding deflation, where in Germany, the biases towards avoiding inflation. Maybe because we haven't had hyperinflation.
Yes, that was going to be, my answer. In the sense that, you know, you remember the worst thing that happened to you.
Right.
And
right.
The worst thing that happened to you was the Great Depression. But, you know,
fair
imagine
enough.
That the U.S. in 1973 completely loses control of inflation. Maybe we will be as obsessed with inflation.
Right. And you know what? And that's a fair point, because I do think some of the concerns the Fed has had, they're fighting the last war. They are fighting against the 1970s repeat in some senses. There's, you know, older people, older generation who worry that we... So I think that might be a fair point. If it had been hyperinflation, it's even more concerned about avoiding that catastrophe. All right, so let's speak to now the contentious claim that the Great Depression led to the rise of the Nazis.
Okay, so I want to be very clear. I'm not going to deny that the Great Depression caused the Nazis coming to power. I just want to emphasize that the mechanism is a little bit subtler. It's not just, oh, the Great Depression, people were unemployed, they were unhappy, they voted the Nazis. Because I think that reading of history teaches us the wrong lessons.
Okay.
So let me tell you, I need to give a little bit of background to people. So first of all, who voted for the Nazis? Back then, we didn't have exit polls. So all the type of things we know about who voted from the Nazis is based on statistical methods. I'm not going to, you know, bore people with the details, but what we believe we know is that there were three types of voters in the Nazi constituency. First, it was Protestant farmers. Politics at the time in Germany was very sectarian. The main determinant of whether you will vote to one party or another was whether you were Catholic or Protestant. So Protestant farmers vote for the Nazis. Protestant urban middle classes, especially artisans, small shopkeepers, lawyers, medical doctors, etc., they vote for the Nazis. And people who were living on a fixed income, like retired workers, renters, etc. The Nazis made very, very little electoral progress among three other groups. First, Catholics, in particular, Catholic farmers and workers. They voted in 1928 and in 1932 to Zentrum, which was the main Catholic party, and there was a small allied Bavarian party with them. You actually look in 1928, in the federal election of 1928, they got 15% of the vote. You look at them in 1932, they got 15% of the vote. So no electoral losses whatsoever.
Okay.
Then you have the skilled manufacturing workers, the guy who is working, I don't know, for the big steel company and has a skilled job. These people kept voting for the Social Democrats, what the party is called, the SPD, is still around. And the Social Democrats lost voters, but they lost voters because a lot of the people got unemployed. But conditional on being employed, people still voted SPD. Where were all the unemployed people going? They were going and start voting communist. The Communist Party in Germany goes from around 10% of the votes in 1928 to nearly 17% of the votes in November 1932. So if you put together the Catholics, the Social Democrats, and the Communists together, they have nearly the same share of votes in 1928, which was around 55%. That in 1932, which was 52%. Okay, so this is very important to remember. Even in 1932, Hitler is never even close to a majority, and 52% of Germans are still voting to parties who are deeply committed anti-Nazis.
Okay.
Okay, so how can it be that Hitler gets to power? Well, he basically does two things. The first one is, remember I was telling you there were all these small anti-system parties? They were called Volkish parties for people. Well, the Nazis are the most dynamic of them. And he basically concentrates the votes that have been in the past divided among all these parties. And I particularly believe that this will have happened no matter what, even without the Great Depression, just because Hitler and the other leadership within the National Socialist Party was much more dynamic and much better prepared for modern electoral politics. The second group that they gather is traditional conservative voters, people that had voted in the past for, remember I mentioned the German National People's Party, the National Conservatives,
yep,
and a more mainstream moderate conservative party called the German People's Party. And Hitler gets around between 60 to 90% of these middle class, traditional conservative Protestant voters. And yes, some of these voters are not doing great during the Great Depression, but the average person in this block is not unemployed. The average person is not in the street searching for a place to live. What these people are really, really afraid is of the very fast growth of the Communist Party. They are really afraid the communists are going to come, they are going to take power, and there is going to be a communist revolution. And what Hitler is promising them is, I'm going to be tougher, and I'm going to be more assertive against the communists, and I'm going to defend the foreign interests of Germany better than all these traditional conservative guys that at the end of the day couldn't deliver. So it's not a, let me say it in terms of economics, it's not a partial equilibrium effect of, oh, I'm unemployed, I vote Nazi. It's a general equilibrium effect.
Okay.
Because there are more unemployed people that are voting communist. I'm a middle class guy who's really very afraid of the communists. So I vote Hitler to be sure that the Nazi thugs will come and will beat up the communists very hard. And that's what I think sometimes people miss, that very part.
Interesting.
To say that this is exactly how the particular details of how Hitler comes to power in January the 30th, 1933. Actually, what some few people remember is that the Nazis, by the end of 1932, are losing votes. The economy is doing a little bit better. People is feeling a little bit more optimistic about the future. There is a second federal election in November of 1932, and the Nazis are losing a lot of votes. And then there are several regional elections where they are losing even more votes. So in the New Year editorial of FAS, the main newspaper in Frankfurt, is still the main newspaper in Germany, they are actually very optimistic about the new year. They say, you know, the Nazi danger is gone. Democracy has survived. And what really happens is, because the traditional conservative elites believe that Hitler now is much weaker, they can bring him into government precisely because he's weaker, use his soldiers and his supporters to destroy the power of the communists and the social democrats, and then get rid of Hitler. Of course, what they cannot count on is that Hitler is going to outmaneuver them. Because when you make a pact with the devil, you end up losing.
Very interesting. So maybe a more accurate short story, and I probably won't get this correctly right altogether, but would be that the Nazis come to power both because of Great Depression issues, but also because of fears of communism.
Yes.
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 Okay. All right. Well, let's move forward, because these stories are interesting. Let's move forward more recently to Germany and Europe and the exchange rate mechanism that occurred in the early 90s. Let's go to that period, where the German currency, the Deutschmark, is the anchor currency for the Europe, the countries that were part of this exchange rate mechanism, the ERM. And tell us what happens then. Germany is again at the center of a monetary controversy here. What's going on now?
Well, during the 1980s, a lot of European countries, particularly France and to a little bit less degree Spain and Italy, start a policy that was called competitive devaluation, or sometimes it's called the policy of the strong franc. And the idea was, if we tie ourselves to the mark, to the German mark, this will control inflation at home. It will force trade unions and the big industry to accept wage moderation and price moderation. And that will help us to break the traditional spiral of high inflation devaluation that many of these countries had gone for decades. I will say that between 1985 to around 1991, this works pretty well. But then you get into the recession of 1992, and there is a lot of speculative attacks, and there is a very large literature done during the 1980s on these speculative attacks. Paul Krugman was one of the main guys in that field, that suggested that the problem of trying to keep a peg is that you are subject to this type of multiplicity of equilibria, which basically means if everyone believes that you are going to keep the peg, you actually don't need a lot of resources, reserves to keep the peg. But if everyone is afraid that the peg is going to be attacked, no matter how many resources you have, at the end of the day, it turns out to be impossible. So you get to this very turbulent 1992-1993, and the sterling pound leaves the mechanism. The British had only reluctantly got into it, so they were always never fully committed to it. But Spain is forced to devaluate several times. And I remember I was at college at the time. It was a national drama that we could not keep the value of the peseta, and everyone, you know, talk about this as nearly as sad as our national team losing a soccer game. And there was the consensus then, after this big monetary storm, that the only way forward was going to the next step, creating a euro, creating a unified currency. And that without a unified currency, the promise of a common market of, by the time the people still started to use the expression, the single market, was going to be impossible. And the French in particular thought, look, at the end of the day, one way or another, we need to have a common monetary policy with the Germans. If the Bundesbank does it in its own, we cannot really do anything but to follow them. If we create a central European central bank, at least we will have something to say in it. So let's do it. The Germans were not terribly convinced by it because they liked their Bundesbank so much. But at the end of the day, their commitment to European integration, which is the basic fundamental cornerstone of German politics in 1945, really pushed them to accept it. So a little bit as a consequence of all these problems and the instability that the exchange rate mechanism had in the early 1990s, we end up having the euro.
Yes, that's an interesting kind of story. It starts after World War II, continues up to the present. And this episode in the middle, as you said, it kind of catalyzes the push towards a common market, common currency. What's fascinating to me, though, is you see the legacy of that early 1920s hyperinflation experience, because the Bundesbank in the early 1990s, what's going on, as you mentioned, is the unification between East and Western Germany. Germany's concerned about they're concerned about inflation from Eastern Germany. So they start to raise interest rates. And any country that pegs is going to have to follow that increase, that tightening, if they want to maintain the peg. And unfortunately for the UK, it was already having weak economic growth. Was it already going into a recession when it had to raise interest rates at that time?
I think so, but I don't recall.
Yeah, that's my recollection. It was already weak. And so this is, you know, it's fascinating story. Where George Soros comes into the picture, right? He bets against the UK because there's no way the government of the United Kingdom will cause its people to suffer so intensely just to maintain this link to the Germans. And again, I mean, all this goes back to the Germans and their big aversion to any whiff of inflation, right? They couldn't tolerate anything happening. So it's neat to see these links, and to understand it, you have to go back in history and understand monetary history.
Yeah. And let me put it also in this way. So imagine that you are a German voter. So I think that people who are critical with the Germans never really try to do the, I would say, exercise of putting themselves in the skin of a German voter. You are in 1992. What have you seen? You have seen that between 1914 to 1945, there were 30 years of hell in your country. Mm-hmm. Everything went wrong. You went from being the most powerful and richest nation in Europe to being destroyed, occupied, a pariah among international nations. After 1945, you say, no. Starting now, I'm going to stabilize inflation. I'm going to balance the budget. I'm going to follow the rule of law. I'm going to be very serious with rules, with policy rules. And by 1992, you are again the richest country in Europe. So how in the world are you going to explain to this voter that a little bit of inflation can be a good idea?
Right, right.
It's just impossible. It goes against everything he has seen. Even if you and me may agree that, you know, doing a little bit of deficit and fiscal stabilization and monetary stabilization may work, what this German is going to tell you is, look, I was an alcoholic. And because of alcoholism, I nearly died. I put my life together and now I'm again rich and prosperous. And you're coming to tell me that there is some empirical evidence that drinking a little bit of red wine at dinner may increase my heart health? No way. But,
right. Great analogy.
Yeah, it's basically what we are telling them.
Yep. And you know, this is, it's again, it's fascinating because there's this common thread going through there, right? This alcoholic story is, and I think it's also part of the story of what's happened in Europe through the Eurozone crisis. Briefly, I'll just mention also the Bretton Woods. Now, Bretton Woods, you know, every currency in the West is tied to the dollar. Yes, the U.S. kind of cheats. It's over-expansionary. But Germany is one of these countries that really complains about it because Germany is having to sterilize all these dollars are flowing in, and it's going to cause a cost. It's going to cost them either fiscally or higher inflation, and they don't want that inflation because of this alcoholic analogy. A story you give. Let's move forward then to the more present, the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. So you have a great paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives that looks at the Eurozone from an interesting angle I hadn't considered, and that is the motivation for the Eurozone is that it would lead to structural reforms. These uncompetitive countries in the periphery would get more efficient, but instead it had the opposite effect. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you were absolutely right. That was the way the euro was sold in Italy or Spain or Portugal. You know, you need to get your act together because now you will not be able to use the exchange rate anymore to recover from bad economic times. What no one foresaw, and this is both among European and among American economists, was that entering into the euro will create or will induce a dramatic fall on the real interest rates that southern European countries had to pay for their debt, which meant, well, I need to pay now only half of the interest rate that I pay before. I can have twice as much debt. And that's exactly what or how people reacted. In the case of Portugal and Greece, it was mainly public debt. In the case of Ireland, which I guess in this case is considered an honorary southerner, and Spain, it was private debt. So we engaged, for instance, in the case of Spain and Ireland, into huge construction booms. Because suddenly you could get mortgages at 3%, 4%, when just a few years before, the only mortgages you could get were at 12%. And this generated a number of very bad political economy dynamics. One of them, for instance, was that politicians could engage in a lot of wasteful spending without serious consequences in the short run. If you talk with people like Paul Krugman, they will tell you, oh, look, Spain had a small government surplus in 2007. So how are you saying that these guys were not fiscally serious? And he's getting it completely wrong. What is happening is the economy is going through this real estate boom. We have this fiscal system that is very, very sensitive to real estate activity in the way it's designed. So Spain was raising a lot of revenue that was not sustainable in the middle run. And at the same time, we were engaging in a lot of public expenditure programs that were not sustainable either in the long run. So let me give you an example. Imagine that you decide to open a new public university in a small town because you want to be sure you get that member of parliament, okay, that people will vote for your party. So you go to that small town and you say, well, I will open a new university for you. And the first year of the university, what is the cost of the university? Next to nothing. Because you just have a founding president and maybe a secretary. The second year, you have a founding president, a secretary, and maybe you hire two or three professors. It's only 10 years later that this is a very expensive public policy program. So that's what the Spanish politicians do between 2004, more or less, and 2008. They promise a huge expansion of public expenditure, but that public expenditure will not take off in another 5-6 years just because of the momentum that you need on these type of things. And at the same time, you are getting all this extra tax revenue because of the bubble. So if you go in 2006 and you tell the voters, hey guys, we are doing something here very, very wrong. We are committing ourselves to a lot of expenses we cannot finance in the long run. The answer that you will get, and I know because I tried to make that argument in 2006, was, but if we have a surplus of 1%, what are you talking about? And we call this a signal extraction problem, which means that voters tend to focus very often on headline numbers and not on structural, cyclically adjusted decisions. And in 2006, 2007, thanks to the bubble created by the euro, a lot of the headline numbers of the Spanish or the Irish economy were very, very good, and there was no incentive for voters to worry about the future because of this signal extraction problem. Okay. And that's the story we are trying to tell.
Yeah, and I think it's a very convincing one. You know, that what you say in the article, that the euro loosened the budget constraints in many of these countries and put off the inevitable day of reckoning, or put off the needed structural reforms that would have avoided the day of reckoning. And, you know, I've written a paper on this myself, and I thought more about it after reading yours. I mean, I think one of the reasons for this is, now that you've joined the Eurozone, implicitly you're backstopped by all the other countries. You're backstopped by the,
exactly,
the EU. And that's why Greece's, you know, long-term yield on bonds could fall so far. I mean, there's this implicit backing, which in some sense has been fulfilled over the past few years. There's another angle, though. I think that's an important part of the story. But you mentioned the bubble. The euro created a bubble. And for me, I'm a monetary policy guy. I look at the ECB as playing a role in that in the following ways. Mm-hmm. And again, ultimately, the ECB is the result of the euro, so you can tie it all back to the euro. But the ECB, you know, when it came into being, Germany was very sluggish, slow growth. You had Ireland, rapid growth. All these countries on the periphery had really faster growth. Germany had slower growth. You're the ECB. What do you do?
Exactly.
You know, and so if you go for the average, it's going to be inappropriate for anyone, right? But Germany makes up a bigger part of the Eurozone. So, you know, I've seen some work on some Taylor rules, and it looks like the ECB did monetary policy that was more consistent with those core countries like Germany. So that monetary policy was too easy for the periphery during the boom years. But during the bust years, more recently, ECB policy has been more appropriate for Germany and too tight for the periphery. So this, I guess my question is, do you see this one-size-fits-all monetary policy that from the ECB being a part of the boom-bust cycle there?
Yes, I think so. Let's think about in terms of the, you know, traditional optimal currency area approach.
Yep.
I don't think the European Union was by any stretch of the imagination an optimal currency area in 1997, and I don't think it's an optimal currency area today. The goal in 1997 was, well, maybe we are not an optimal currency area today, but once we bind ourselves into this Eurozone, we will eventually become one. It hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened because at the end of the day, you know, you have the language barrier. In the US, if you are from Massachusetts, you can pick up the car and drive to Texas, and they roughly speak the same language. If you are from the southern of Spain, you pick up your car, you drive to north of Germany, and they speak something totally different.
Right.
And it's not only the language, it's the culture, the food, the arts, the TV. And that's never, no matter how much you try to fix that, that's not going to disappear for many generations. Second factor is we don't have a federal budget of any meaningful sense. The European Union budget is only around 1% of the European area of the Eurozone GDP. So you cannot do any type of meaningful fiscal transfers. And that's a problem. Basically says that the Eurozone has a fundamental design flaw. Now, the question then is, what do we do about it? So, and here is where my position has always been a little bit nuanced. So I was against the creation of the euro. I think I was one of the very, very few Spanish economists who thought the euro was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And believe me, when I was saying those things in the late 1990s, people thought I was a lunatic, but fine. And
it's true. Most American economists were warning. Most European economists were for it. So you're right.
Exactly. And I think that most European economists were just too much in love with the idea of the European unification to put it ahead of their economic sense. I think that if you have taken that very same European economies and tell them that Brazil and Argentina were going to get into a monetary union, they will have said, no way, this will never work.
Yeah.
Fine. But now that we are into the euro, I'm not sure we need to break it up. This is a little bit the same that, you know, getting married is a very different decision than getting a divorce.
Interesting.
Okay. You may be reluctant to get married, but once you have a wife and three kids and a mortgage, you know, divorce can be really costly.
Right.
And that's my view right now about the euro, that breaking it up will be so costly. And more than be so costly, it opens so many unknown unknowns that I don't think we should do that. So the relevant question, in my opinion, is which is the set of reforms we need to introduce to be sure that this euro area works, and this very fundamental asymmetry between what is good for Germany and what is good for Portugal can be somehow fixed.
That sounds like a tall order. Something very difficult to do. I mean, what you mentioned the optimal currency area idea, and I thought of that when I was reading your paper, and really what these folks were arguing was for an endogenous optimal currency area. The idea in the literature that, look, we're not an optimal currency area now, but just wait and see. Once we've got those open borders, there'll be more competition, less exchange rate uncertainty, and we'll see firms across the EU converge, and never happened. And so you have this massive misalignments of real exchange rates. And so it is interesting to see. I got to throw an idea out there by you and see what you think. So some observers have suggested that we keep the EU, but we actually form a second currency. So maybe the euro stays put with some of the countries in the periphery, maybe even France, but Germany and maybe a few other austere countries leave and form kind of a more hard currency. Is that, one, possible, and two, a good idea?
Let me put it in this way. I'm a little bit of a conservative with lowercase c.
Okay.
In the following sense, I really think that as economists, we suffer from the pretense of knowledge, as F.A. Hayek will say.
Yep.
And I'm very suspicious of anyone try to say, oh, you know, I work out through this institution in the blackboard of my office and I got all the incentive constraints right, this is going to work right. So my instinct reaction about any reform in monetary terms tends to be always, I don't know, I'm really worried about it. But, you know, that's a little bit my personal bias. I just wanted to point that out. I think my personal view is that having those type of currencies will give or will take away from Southern Europe the very last amount of discipline and commitment that has been left after the crisis. And it will do it in a moment where right now being at the euro is not such a bad idea. If you look at the real exchange rate of Spain, Portugal, or Greece, it is probably where it should be.
Okay.
You look at fundamentals, and you know, I know I do econometrics, so I know this is hard. But if you look at where the real wages in Spain should be, given our level of productivity, they are more or less where they should be.
Okay.
If you look at the real estate prices, I would say that, in fact, most real estate in Spain now is undervalued. So in some sense, leaving now the euro is not really going to help as much. You know, it may be the case that in 10 years, when the real exchange rate is again misaligned, it will be useful. But thus, creating two currencies may have make sense in 2010. It doesn't make sense now, where we have already paid the adjustment cost.
All right. So I mean, one of the issues is, you know, if you can't adjust your exchange rate, then you have to adjust domestic prices to stay competitive. And so what you're saying is, that has already happened. The deflation these countries have experienced has put their real exchange rates more in line where they need to be. All right, very interesting. Well, let's move on, the time we have left, to your other area of expertise, and that is macroeconomic modeling. And there's a lot of issues, a lot of heat being thrown around these days about DSGEs. And for our listeners, in case you don't know, that's dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, which is kind of the workhorse of modern macroeconomics. If you get a PhD, you have to learn these models, and you know they're being used in the literature, even published research. They're important to know. So where does the kind of state of the art now stand with DSGEs, and what do we make of these critiques? Paul Romer recently lobbed a few grenades at the DSGEs. and I guess my question is, are they useful? Are they practical? We use them as academics, but where does it stand?
Okay. Well, this is a huge question. So let me pick up the highest marginal utility parts of the answer.
Okay.
Well, I think that when people say DSG models, it's one of the situations where different people mean different things.
Okay.
Because you know, parse the name, dynamic. Well, of course, we want models that are dynamic. I mean, who wants a model that is static?
Right.
Stochastic. Stochastic means that there are shocks. Of course, we want models that have shocks. And general equilibrium. Well, of course, we want models in general equilibrium. We want to see how the economy interacts. So at a very abstract level, who can be against a model that has these properties? So in that sense, you can think about DSG models as just saying, well, let's write models of the aggregate economy that are dynamic and that have probabilistic structures and that have a general equilibrium component. What I think many of the critics complain about are about some of the very concrete modeling choices that these models have. And different people pick different parts that they don't like. And it's a little bit hard to go over all the criticisms because some of them are well-informed and some of them are, and I'm sorry if I sound a little bit harsh, not that well-informed.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, things that I agree with the critics, general equilibrium models or DSG models could do much better, pricing. In the way prices are set up in our models, especially of the new Keynesian fashion, it's a little bit silly. You know, there is like some exogenous process that lets firms change prices or not, or maybe they need to pay some menu prices, some menu costs to change their prices. But we haven't really made a lot of progress in truly understanding how prices are set up.
Is this the Calvo Ferry you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So the Calvo Ferry, for the listeners who do not know it, is this very silly abstraction where you flip a coin, and if it is heads, I can change my price, and if it is tails, I cannot. And, you know, it kind of works. It's an approximation to a better problem. But like all approximations, there are some cases where it makes sense and there are so many other cases where it doesn't. And the problem with all literatures in, and macro is not different, is you have 10 people doing good work, but you have another 10 people who, you know, do not fully get it. Maybe the way they apply the paper doesn't make a lot of sense. Other aspect of the model where I'm of the standard DSG models where I'm very critical of is what Tom Sarien calls the communism of expectations. And what he means by that is that everyone in the model has the same expectations and the same set of beliefs. And we know that's not true. We know that, you know, you go in 2012, you put together not even 10 economists, but 10 participants in the bond market, or 10 people who were major hedge fund investors, and you ask them, what do you think is going to happen with the dollar over the next year? What do you think is going to happen with the interest rate? They're going to tell you very different stories. So we really need to face models where people have different beliefs about the world, different sets of information, et cetera, and making progress along those dimensions is hard. Some of the other criticisms, I think, are less well-founded. So, for instance, Paul Romer makes a big fuss about identification problems. Identification, in a very quick way, is whether or not there is enough information in the data to tell models apart or to learn about parameters of the model. And I found that criticism very puzzling because I go to the econometric seminar regularly. I sit there, I write papers in econometrics, and you know, half of the papers are about identification. You can complain, we have not made a lot of progress. That may be a fair criticism, but complaining that we don't care about it seems completely wrong-headed. So I think that for the time being, DSE models are still going to be the workhorse, probably. And, you know, we are going to write better and better models. And in particular, what I think we are very close to is a big revolution in having heterogeneous agents. So let me explain this for people who may be a little bit less familiar. So in the standard macro model, we have what we call a representative agent, a household that stands for all the households in the economy. And you know, for some problems, that's not a bad approximation. But if you want to talk about inequality, if you want to talk about life cycle issues, if you want to talk about tax policy, these type of models do not make a lot of sense. And we really wanted to write models with heterogeneous agents, but it was always very hard and very difficult. And over the last four years, there has been a lot of advances, both in terms of methods and in terms of computation. And that's what I have done a lot of my, you know, day-to-day research is precisely there, that are really opening the door to what I think will be a new generation of models with individual heterogeneity, which will probably teach us a lot of very interesting things about the economy.
Now, going down that path with heterogeneous agents, I mean, you're addressing this concern you have about the communism of expectations, that if you have these different agents, you have different expectations. You know, if you take that to the limit, I guess another interesting question is, does this lead us down the path to agent-based modeling, or is this different?
This is different in the sense that you are really trying to be much closer to traditional economics. Mm-hmm. You are only introducing, for instance, different set of beliefs about some stochastic processes, etc. While agent-based modeling was more about, let's have models where you have this very simple automata that follow a very reduced set of instructions, and let's see what happens. And in the same way that you could argue that the rational expectation representative agent model is an agent that is way too sophisticated, my view always has been that these very simple automata are, on the other hand, a little bit too simple.
Okay.
That people sit down and actually think about it. Let me put it in this way. When I bought my house, my wife and I were deciding how much we wanted to pay as down payment, how much to borrow, how much to keep in the stock market. You know, we did our numbers.
Yeah.
You know, we may have been wrong. I may have had the wrong expectations about where the market was going to be in the next year. But it's not that we just randomly follow some rule of thumb. And something that is important to remember is a lot of the prices and allocation in the economy are not democratically weighted by the number of people, but they are wealth weighted. It's way more important for an economy that Bill Gates gets his investment right than 1 million people that have $20 in their checking account get their investment right. And my suspicion is that Bill Gates have a lot of very smart people doing their investment decisions for him.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left. I want to go down one last avenue in this discussion on modeling, because it's near and dear to my heart as a money guy, and that is how we deal with money in these models. So traditionally, if you wanted to look at money in a DSGE model, you'd put it in the money in the utility function, or you'd use a cash in advance constraint. And that was the way you did money in the models. But those were always kind of questionable, or particularly the cash in advance constraint. That always bothered me because money enters as a friction, right? Money's a friction, but in reality, money emerges as a way to reduce search cost, transaction cost. And so it, you know, always kind of bothered me. And now, but now we have these new models, which you've done a lot of work on. I've tinkered with some with co-authors in them, but you've done a lot of work with the Lagos Wright models of monetary search. And my question to you is, do you see it getting more and more acceptance? Because, you know, frankly, we've submitted some articles, gotten pushback. Oh, we don't like these type of models. I mean, what is your sense of the field? Is the field heading more towards these monetary search model angles?
Okay, so I have a little bit of an eclectic view on that.
Mm-hmm.
My perspective is that there are some questions for which having money in the utility function is okay.
Okay.
So probably if we are going to think about, I don't know, the normal business cycle, and you want to think about the effects of productivity shocks or the effect of an oil shock, the search frictions are not going to be of the essence. So you may as well write a model with more in the utility function. We have many simplifications in the model, so that's just another one. And there are other questions for which modeling money explicitly is fundamental. And those questions involve issues like what I have been working recently, cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Several of my students are currently thinking about models of the financial sector, models where, for instance, there are brokers and dealers and there is repo and you need to find someone who wants to take the other side of a contract. And over there, search is really of the essence. So I will say it depends a little bit on what you want to use these models for.
Okay.
If I can be a little bit critical with the essential models of money, with the Lagos Wright tradition, and you know, I do this with deep admiration for Randy Wright, who was my colleague for many, many years, and for Neil Wallace and Nobu Kiyotaki, who have always been very nice and very kind to me. That literature suffered a few times from a little bit too much worried about proving a theorem and a little bit little concern from having to say something interesting about current problems.
Yep.
Okay, so it's not that I'm against proving theorems. I have proved a few in my life and that are perfectly fine. But especially not kind of the core members of the group, but kind of maybe in the fringe, kind of the second level. A lot of times, many of the papers were literature driven. In the sense that people will prove, oh, I have this new model, and I have this model with a random search. And then they will come and say, oh, but now I'm going to do the model, but with a slightly different version and a slightly different thing. And then they will work for like 10 years on that. And that meant that many macroeconomists thought that some of these essential models of money were a little bit kind of a subgroup that will talk with each other. Mm-hmm. But I really believe that these models are very important. And I really believe that more and more we are going to see people using this type of models to talk about a lot of interesting things. And if you go to Randy Wright's webpage at Wisconsin and you look at about some of the stuff he's doing these days about assets and financial markets and the effects of monetary policy type of things, you will, I think, are really truly a lot quite exceptionally good papers and deep papers.
Very interesting. Well, on that note, we have to end. We're out of time. Our guest today has been Jesus Fernandez Villaverde. Jesus, thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, thanks for being here. It has been a lot of fun.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.